If they are intent on continuing the occupation, so it will provoke a reaction.
A Taliban spokesman says U.S. evacuations must end at the end of the month. It's Tuesday, August 24th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, the U.N. wants an air bridge to get aid to Afghans. Australia must start to learn to live with COVID-19. Some international students in the United States are struggling to get vaccinated. The U.S. has opened a meeting with North Korea, and the captain of Afghanistan's women wheelchair basketball team flees her country. It is all on today's VOA Asia. A Taliban spokesman says extending the deadline of August 31st for the withdrawal of international troops from Afghanistan is something the organization cannot accept. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Taliban spokesman Sahail Shaheen, speaking in an interview with UK broadcaster Sky, says if the US extends, that means they're extending occupation. And the group would respond. He didn't say how, though.
If they are intent on continuing the occupation, so it will provoke a reaction.
Shaheen adds any extension would to create mistrust between the Taliban and the US. He also denied Afghans were attempting to flee the country due to fear of the Taliban. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
However, President Biden says the U.S.-led evacuation of Americans, at-risk Afghans, and others from the Kabul airport accelerated this weekend and will continue. AP correspondent Ben Thomas has more.
Altogether, we lifted approximately 11,000 people out of Kabul in less than 36 hours.
At a White House news conference Sunday, Biden acknowledged discussions are underway among military officials about potentially extending the airlift beyond his August 31st deadline.
Our hope is we will not have to extend, but there are going to be discussions, I suspect, on how far along we are in the process.
Biden also noted the Islamic State group's Afghan affiliate is a threat.
Every day we have troops on the ground. These troops, innocent civilians at the airport, face the risk of attack from ISIS-K from a distance, even though we're moving back the perimeter significantly.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
Our coverage of Afghanistan continues in a moment. This is VOA Asia. Here are some of the stories you'll find at voanews.com. Thousands are leaving Hong Kong. Teachers quit amid security law and pandemic. Afghanistan flag to be displayed in Paralympic ceremony. More than two dozen Rohingya are missing and feared drowned after their boat sank in the Bay of Bengal when they were fleeing a refugee settlement located on a remote Bangladeshi island. More Paralympic athletes arrive in Tokyo on Monday, a day before the Paralympic Games are set to open, even as the country continues to have soaring COVID-19 infections. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the voanews.com website. The World Health Organization and UNICEF are calling for the establishment of a humanitarian air bridge to deliver life-saving assistance to millions of vulnerable people in Afghanistan. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Since the Taliban seized control of Afghanistan, major air operations at Kabul Airport have been focused on evacuating internationals and vulnerable Afghans. This operation has gone ahead at the expense of aid deliveries by UN agencies. For example, the World Health Organization reports it was unable to deliver 500 tons of medical supplies this week, including surgical equipment, trauma medicines, and treatments for childhood pneumonia because of Kabul airport restrictions. Spokesman for the UN Children's Fund, James Elder, tells VOA the WHO shipment also included nutritional food for the treatment of malnourished children.
We fear that you could have as many as a million children under the age of five suffering from severe acute malnutrition this year. That's the most dangerous form. That's the type of malnutrition that kills. we need to continually ensure that those supplies are on the ground. And a lot of that does take airlifts. Now we have a lot of supplies in country, but it's not an exhaustive amount. We need to continually replenish those.
That, he explains, is why WHO and UNICEF are calling for the establishment of a humanitarian air bridge. He says this would ensure that life-saving supplies could come into the country while evacuations were taking place. Elder notes that conditions in Afghanistan are perilous. He says humanitarian needs remain as critical now as they were before this conflict came to a head. Even before the current crisis, he says Afghanistan represented the third largest humanitarian operation in the world. Since no commercial aircraft currently can land in Kabul, he says a humanitarian air bridge would allow aircraft delivering aid to continue to use the airport.
It just requires authorities on the ground to ensure that humanitarian agencies, the big ones who do these types of things, World Food Programme, UNICEF, and of course what we're talking here with regard to these medicines, WHO, it's what they do day in, day out in inverted commas, normal times, and just needs to continue now, despite what look like chaotic scenes at that airport.
The United Nations reports that nearly half of Afghanistan's population, or 18 million people, among them 10 million children, require life-saving assistance. This number includes 300,000 people who fled their homes in the last 2 months, while Taliban insurgents were closing in on the country's former rulers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, Taiwan's president has received the first dose of that island's controversial domestically produced coronavirus vaccine. Tsai Ing-wen's inoculation Monday initiated the public rollout of the vaccine. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Australia must start to learn to live with COVID-19 when higher vaccination targets are reached, so said their Prime Minister Scott Morrison Monday, despite concerns in some states about the impact of a surge in cases in Sydney. Emma McCarthy reports.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison is saying that the country will need to learn to live with COVID and start lifting its lockdown restrictions once more of the population is vaccinated, despite concerns about the impact of the recent surge in cases in Sydney.
Once you get to 70% of your country that is eligible for the vaccine, and 80%, the plan sets out that we have to move forward. We cannot hold back.
The federal government last month unveiled a four-stage plan to relax restrictions once 70% of over 16s are vaccinated. With over half of all Australians stuck in weeks-long lockdowns to curb the highly infectious Delta strain, Morrison said the country had to move forward.
We must adjust our mindset. Cases will not be the issue once we get above 70%. Dealing with serious illness, hospitalisation, ICU capabilities, our ability to respond in those circumstances, that will be our goal. And we will live with this virus as we live with other infectious diseases. That's what the national plan is all about, was always about. That's how we designed it, and that's how it needs to be implemented.
The states of Western Australia and Queensland, however, have flagged that they may not stick to a plan reached with federal government, even if vaccination rates hit 80%, raising concerns due to Sydney breaking new one-day records for infections. While Australia has managed the pandemic better than many other developed countries, a slow vaccine rollout has taken the shine off its early success. Nationally, 30% of the population above 16 are fully vaccinated, while 52% have had at least one dose. Vaccinations are running at a record pace, but the target of 80% fully vaccinated will not be reached until December at the current rate.
That was Reuters' Emma McCarthy. Chris Hipkins, a government minister in New Zealand, admits that the country's elimination approach to achieve a COVID-zero status may no longer be viable, as the Delta variant is proving difficult to control. The government in Wellington has extended a nationwide lockdown until at least Friday, and 107 infections have been detected so far. Stay-at-home orders in the city of Auckland, the center of the outbreak, will remain until at least August 31st. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
New Zealand has been imposing lockdowns at the first sign of an outbreak, implementing a strategy to crush COVID-19 and curb the spread of the virus. It also closed its borders to most foreign nationals in March 2020 and returning citizens are subject to strict quarantine controls. The country has tried to keep the pandemic at bay and earned the name Fortress New Zealand due to the strategy. However, the government is now admitting there are cracks in the country's approach in combating the pandemic. Health officials have linked the Delta variant outbreak to a traveller who returned from the Australian state of New South Wales on August 7. Chris Hipkins, the COVID-19 response minister, told a local TV station, TVNZ Sunday, that eliminating the virus would be a difficult task.
Delta does raise some big questions that we're going to have to grapple with. You know, less than 24 hours between someone getting it and then passing it on to others. That's like nothing we've dealt with in this pandemic so far. And that does change everything. It does mean that all of our existing protections start to look less adequate and less robust as a result of that. So we're looking very closely at what more we can do there. But yes, it does raise some pretty big questions about what the long-term future of our plans are.
Australia is also moving away from its long-held elimination strategy. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has warned that people would have to learn to live with the virus. But he said lockdowns would continue until at least 70% of the population was fully vaccinated. So far, just under a third of Australians have received two doses. A nighttime curfew in virus-hit parts of Sydney began Monday as Delta variant infections increase in Australia's biggest city. Masks are now mandatory for all residents outdoors. The police have been given greater powers to lock down apartment blocks and order people to isolate for 14 days if they break any restrictions. New South Wales and Victoria, Australia's most populous states, are in lockdown, along with the national capital, Canberra. New Zealand has recorded about 3,000 coronavirus cases and 26 deaths since the pandemic began. Australia has reported 44,000 infections and 981 deaths, according to the country's health department. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
After you listen to VOA Asia, see it. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free and see us often on VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. South Korea's foreign minister said on Monday the United States discussed at a very basic level using its bases in South Korea to temporarily house refugees from Afghanistan. But talks on the issue have not progressed. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Some international students in the United States are struggling to get fully vaccinated against COVID-19 before returning to school this fall. Connor Smith has this report.
While COVID-19 cases are rising again, international students returning to the U.S. are finding it difficult to get vaccinated. Jenny Zhang came from China to study at Columbia University in New York. She got the Sinopharm vaccine this spring in Beijing. The vaccine has been approved by the World Health Organization, or WHO, and her school. Now, back in the U.S., Zhang is considering a Pfizer or Moderna booster.
I was a bit worried about my, vaccination, because I did hear that, you know, the Sinopharm one might not be as effective, especially against the Delta variant.
Before coming back to the States in May, Zhang spent 2 weeks quarantining in Dubai. Like China, the U.S. restricts incoming travelers.
I just stayed in the hotel for 2 weeks. It was not very enjoyable.
Yoon-ha Hun, a South Korean, came back to the U.S. early to get vaccinated and stay with her aunt in Northern Virginia. COVID-19 is on the rise in South Korea, and only 20% of the population is fully vaccinated. Hun attends Pratt Institute in New York, where students must either get vaccinated or quarantine for 2 weeks. Shots are available for students upon their return.
If they were requiring students to quarantine for 2 weeks, I feel like they should at least provide a space for them to quarantine, because a lot of international students don't have a place to stay in the state.
Syracuse University student Jessica Tran had trouble getting inoculated in her home country of Vietnam, where vaccinations didn't begin in earnest until July.
We have received vaccines from the UK and from China and from Japan, and unfortunately those are not the vaccines that are currently used in the U.S.
Like many U.S. colleges and universities, Syracuse says it is working with international students on a case-by-case basis.
Vaccinations are readily available in Syracuse, and we do not anticipate that international students will experience any difficulty in obtaining the vaccine once they arrive. Students who get vaccinated upon arrival must wear a mask and participate in weekly COVID testing until 2 weeks after their final vaccine dose.
And so right now I'm not going into the city as much. I think back at school, if I know that everyone is vaxxed, then I'd be a lot more comfortable.
Most students will return to university between now and mid-September. Connor Smith for VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA Asia. Making headlines in Asia, China's health authority reported Monday that there were no new locally transmitted cases of COVID-19 for the first time since July, offering more signs that the current outbreak, which began late last month, may be tapering off soon. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the United States does not have hostile intent toward Pyongyang and is open to meeting anytime and any place. Washington's special envoy for North Korea said that Monday during a visit to South Korea. Reuters' Jason Albano reports.
The U.S. and South Korea want to bring North Korea back into talks to denuclearize. On Monday, Washington's special envoy for North Korea, Song Kim, met with his counterpart in Seoul. His visit comes amid a simmering new standoff over Washington and Seoul's annual joint military exercises that Pyongyang warned could trigger a security crisis. The North sees these exercises as a rehearsal for war against it. But Kim tried to tamp down that tension.
The United States does not have hostile intent towards the DPRK. The ongoing U.S.-ROK combined military exercises are longstanding, routine, and purely defensive in nature, and support the security of both of our countries.
He also urged Pyongyang to come to the table.
I continue to stand ready to meet with my North Korean counterparts anywhere at any time. On the importance of the U.S.-ROK alliance, I cannot put it better than President Biden himself, who called the U.S. commitment to the defense of the Republic of Korea sacred.
A brief thaw in relations between the two Koreas in June saw a hotline between the two reopen last month. That was a year after North Korea suspended them. But the moment didn't last. After preliminary training for the exercises began last week, the North stopped answering the phone. State media in Pyongyang has so far also been silent since the start of the drills. That's despite fears that the country could conduct a missile test or take other actions to display its disapproval.
Jason Albano reporting. We continue on VOA Asia. Niloufar Bayat, the captain of Afghanistan's women's wheelchair basketball team, arrived in Spain Friday after fleeing from Kabul, where she encountered the Taliban in the chaos of Kabul airport. Reuters' Libby Hogan reports.
The Taliban left an impact early on Afghan basketballer Niloufar Bayat. In an instant, they changed her life forever. Bayat, who was the captain of Afghanistan's women's wheelchair basketball team, was just 2 years old when a rocket hit her house in Kabul, injuring her spinal cord.
The bad memory I had, it was about Taliban, because they came, they changed my life, they changed his life. They came and put it a non-stoppable pain in our life, a permanent disability that we will have this in whole life.
In the wake of the Taliban's takeover last week, she joined the thousands desperate to leave the country. For days, she and her husband Ramesh waited amid the chaos at Kabul's airport.
Taliban are shooting around and it's too difficult. They are shouting. They don't hear what we say. We had a very difficult time, but now fortunately I'm here with Ramesh and just sitting and we are waiting.
In recent years, Bayat was hopeful things were changing in Afghanistan. She was part of a generation that enjoyed freedoms for women with access to education and work. She and her husband, who was also injured by a mine, wanted to stay in the capital, Kabul, and keep improving the country. But their dreams were cut short.
They would destroy all the wishes and all the achievements, all what we did in the last 20 years. In Afghanistan, we had too many wishes. Like, I was thinking about to improve for my basketball, with my job, with my studies, this all.
Now, she has been offered to play for a wheelchair basketball team in the northern Spanish city of Bilbao. Thanks to the Spanish government and the Spanish Basketball Federation, she was given a place on a plane out of Kabul, arriving to safety on Friday. Although she is safe in Spain, her heart is still in Afghanistan.
I want to tell them that you are so, so strong that you are still there. We know living in Afghanistan is not easy. We pray from here for them to be safe. And please, don't give up. And don't accept all the rules of Taliban, because if you accept today, they will put another rule tomorrow.
Libby Hogan reporting. In the heart of Manhattan, a pair of unlikely neighbors after a family of hawks built their nest near the window of an apartment building. Two families, human and fowl, are now watching each other, and the world is watching them through social media. Anna Nelson was fortunate enough to see this interaction with her own eyes. Anna Rice narrates her report.
Michael Palmamir grew up in New York City. For as long as he can remember, the Big Apple's fauna was limited to cheeky pigeons and rats. He never imagined he would have wildlife neighbors settling in right outside his apartment windows.
Early March, late February, early March, I would hear a pecking at the window, and I couldn't understand what it was. I poked my head out of another window to see. And when I poked my head out, I saw that the red-tailed hawk was standing right there on the fire escape. I went in to look for my camera with a long lens. I took a picture, and then I saw him coming right at me. When I saw that, I went back in and I shut my window. My heart was beating. And I thought, well, that's it. I'm never going to see them again, but at least I have one good picture.
But the hawks, there ended up being two, had no plans to leave. So while the birds were away, Michael installed a few tiny cameras by their nest, closed the blinds, and stopped trying to interfere in their lives. The next day, as he checked the cameras, he noticed two eggs in the nest. The new arrivals became a sensation. The footage from Mir's cameras that he uploaded to an Instagram account became popular all around the world.
First time I see that bird right there. You got the nest right there and all that.
Isn't it amazing?
I think they sense when they can be in a place that's safe.
Mir got attached to his wildlife neighbors and even gave names to the two grown birds, Lily and Billy. They lost one chick, but the other one is doing great, a symbol of resilience and contrast, just like New York City itself. For Anna Nelson in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, Amy Hybels, Chris Cascayo, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman. Please stay healthy and enjoy the day ahead.